That's why I've got a little bit of Mancunian accent with me. Yeah, it was there that I was kind of exposed to other cultures. And that was the place where I was required to give a defense for the faith that I held so dearly. And I said that this is what I believe in. But it doesn't make sense when people ask questions. How am I going to answer or give a reason for the hope that I have in Christ? And that was the time when I started pursuing apologetics and theology and started learning more about it and got interested in that and was greatly challenged. And I found out that there were credible answers to all these different questions that people ask concerning all that they encounter in culture. So that's how I got interested in apologetics. And from there, I went to Oxford, pursued my studies in theology and apologetics, and from there we came to Biola, and we've been here in America for almost 2 years now. My wife is also here. And, it was not planned that she would be joining us. That's why I have her picture here. but now she is here with me, so yeah. So this is the premise I want to start with. Why is it that, I don't want to sound pessimistic or negative when I start, you know. Why is it that in our culture today, we find that we have come to a generation which looks more, you know, what like theologian Carl Henry said, that intellectually uncapped, morally unzippered, and volitionally uncurved, you know? Why is it that we've become more like this? Why is it that Christianity is dismissed today as a kind of middle-class hedonism? It is no more considered as valid faith or a belief that could exist in our culture today. So we'll start with that question. But I want to bring in one of the examples and place it before you before we get into the argument as to what cultural relativism is. And I was supposed to speak on moral relativism and cultural relativism. I'll be focusing more on cultural relativism. There's a lot of material available on the slides, and you have the photocopies available with you. But I may not be going through everything here this evening. It's available for you to go back home and go through all those different quotes that are there. But how many of you know about this case, Ted Bundy, who confessed to 30 homicides that were committed sometimes between 1974 and 1978? And he, in a way, he was very articulate. He made his point very clear. And I think, even though it's like 3 decades ago, but still, he spoke, you know, based on what he was observing around him. And he was very articulate in saying certain things. He said that, then I learned that all moral judgments are value judgments, that all value judgments are subjective, and that none can be proved to be either right or wrong. He goes on to say that I figure out for myself that if the rationality of one value judgment was zero, multiplying it by millions would not make it one whit more rational, right? If the value of any value judgment is zero, you multiply it with no matter how many value judgments, it will be still zero. It does make sense, right? Based on what he says. And he goes on to say, and I quickly discovered that the greatest obstacle to my freedom, the greatest block and limitation to it, consists in the insupportable value judgment that I was bound to respect the rights of others. And he decided not to. And he went on his own way. So he was following the philosophy of the time that was this, that you have your way, I have my way. As for the right way, it does not exist. Friedrich Nietzsche, right? And we find today, especially in academia, the place where we say that we go and pursue truth, that's the place where we find that people hold this view, that there is nothing called truth that exists. I have my way and you have yours. Let's coexist. Sounds good, right? But what happens when this trickles down to a culture? When culture as a group or a society adopts such kind of view? It is Franz Boas, who is known to be the father of American anthropology. He says this, it goes, the civilization is not something absolute, but it is relative. And our ideas and conceptions are true only so far as our civilization goes, right? So we have two questions before us. Does it really matter how we behave, both individually and as a society. Whether moral values exist independently of human social creations. These are some crucial questions as we need to be asking as a community, as a culture, as a nation, right? And how we answer these questions will define where we go from here. So today we're going to talk about relativism. And as I said, I won't be discussing about moral relativism much, but we'll spend more time on cultural relativism. And both of them are part of ethics. They're not part of social sciences, they're part of ethics. And what we're trying to actually do under those two ways that we have, we're trying to define how an action can be defined as right or wrong. So what we are trying to do is, an action is right and wrong if and only if, first, intentions. The person who holds intentions, that would define whether an action is right or wrong. If you have good intentions, what you're going to do is going to be good. If you have bad intentions, what you're going to do is going to be bad. The other is, an action is right or wrong if most pleasure for greater number of people is available. The utilitarian idea. If you do something and majority of people are benefited by that, then it's a good action. Then there is third, where you appeal to a transcendent creator, where we depend on a divine command. Something is good because God calls it good. Something is good because God is good, and it comes out from his nature because he is good. And finally, it is a culture that determines what is good or wrong. And that's what we're going to focus our time on. So when we talk about relativism, there is one thing that we are going to exclude. Any objective idea, especially any objective moral value. And when we talk about objective moral value, there are key ingredients. One is a standard, something that provides a measure of good or bad, right or wrong. And the second is an authority, someone or something that has the right to impose the standard and enforce adherence. So there are two questions that we should be asking. And during our time together here, I'll be speaking for another maybe half an hour, but during this time, please focus on these two questions. One is ontological, that is the source of objective moral values. Where do we get it from? And the second is how we come to know, which is more epistemological question. So keep these two things in your mind. Where do we get our moral values from, and how do we get it? So what are we trying to actually exclude? So there are two ways to moral judgment. One is objectivism. I don't know how many of you have heard of these terms. I'm sure you might have in your classes earlier. Objectivism and relativism. So what are we saying? The basic idea under objectivism is that our moral judgments are the sort of things that can be true or false, and what makes them true or false are facts that are generally independent of who we are or what cultural groups we belong to. They are objective moral facts. And opposite to that is relativism, which says that moral judgments are indeed true or false. They're not denying that. They are true or false. But they are only true or false relative to something that can vary between people. So they are not objective. They are not appealing to any objective realm. So what is cultural relativism? Here the basic idea, and this is the predominant idea of our culture today. Relativism, right? Cultural relativism. Our moral judgments are indeed true or false, but they are only true or false relative to the culture of the person who makes them. So if I say X is good, what I'm saying is that the culture approves that X is good, and I conform to the cultural mandate. But keep one thing in mind, as I said, cultural relativism does not approve moral nihilism. The cultural relativist recognizes society's moral values and even endorses them. He only denies that they are grounded in an objective realm. They're not saying that a value cannot be true, a value cannot be good or bad. What they're saying is that you can't say that it's objectively and universally applicable. Joseph Fletcher, who came up with situation ethics, he says that cultural relativism is the view that societies create their own traditions. pass them along from one generation to another and continually reinforce them through rewards and punishment. That's important. More of a Freudian idea coming up here. On this view, morality is a distinctly human invention. It is not something that is revealed. It is not something that is dispatched to a community. It is purely our invention. And it makes no sense to make for a foundation of morality outside of human social approval. And this is not a new idea. Even the Greeks had this, you know. They were very clear that different polis or metropolis had its own peculiar code of conduct and that none was superior to any other. But there had been an impetus. When we read William Sumner, who wrote in Folk Ways, he says that now there is the apparent mass of scientific evidences that support this idea. Now there are social scientists who are involved in this endeavor of proving that cultures are different. They behave in different ways. They have different value judgments or modes of defining what is good and bad, right? And they have scientific evidences now to prove that. But is that the case? That's what we're going to look at. So when is it that we actually encounter cultural relativism? There are two times that it specifically comes out. One is when you have to do international business. I don't know how many of you are here in business and have traveled abroad to actually expand your business. There are countries where you have to go, and you may not even call it bribery, but that's the norm. You have to pay, you know, to get certain things accomplished. So how are you going to deal with that situation? Here in America, if you bribe someone, you'll be put in prison, right? In jail. It's a moral issue here. But you travel to a country, I don't want to name any specific country, but there are countries, you go there, and the time you land at the airport, you have to continue, you know, bribing everyone to accomplish things. Second is multiculturalism. I don't know how many of you have heard of this, which is about greater appreciation of and tolerance for culture. And you might have come across these statements recently being made by some European prime ministers, including Cameron, Nicolas Sarkozy, Angela Merkel. They said that multiculturalism has failed. I've had the privilege of staying in UK for some time, and I have personally witnessed it. There are places in UK, can you imagine, where you would hesitate to go. And even if you go, you may not feel like you are in a developed nation. You're not in a place, you will feel like it's like an underdeveloped place, and you won't feel that you're following the same rules that you would follow maybe 3 miles away from that place, right? What's happening here? And we have to understand there is a lot of cultural interaction now. People are traveling to different countries, right? People are coming and immigrating to Western countries. So this is bringing a lot of challenges. Multiculturalism has indeed failed. You won't believe the Archbishop of Canterbury, William Robins, he even came out with this statement during one of his interviews. He said that, you know, European countries must find accommodation with Islamic law courts and allow Islamic law to have its place in the law of various European countries. Think about that. He was the Archbishop of Canterbury at that point of time, and this is what he said. There is a sort of giving into the pressure that is there, that culture brings with itself. So there are two things that you can't do, and it's happening here in America, and I have a mandate. And I have come with this mandate also, I would say, to warn my dear fellow Americans, don't lose your exclusive claim, right? The idea of exclusivism. You are not one among everyone. You are in a place where everyone does follow. I don't know of anyone, I've never heard of anyone who wants to actually move out of this country and settle. You know, for example, I've never heard of anyone taking a boat from here and going to Cuba. But I've heard of many cases where people from Cuba want to come here and settle. Why is it so? And the other idea is about integration. Think about this. Here, America is known for that. People come from different countries, they want to come here, and they should integrate here. But that doesn't happen always in all the places. So you can't talk about that anymore. So what is the argument and defense for cultural relativism? The idea is that different cultures have different moral codes, okay? One culture buries its dead, another burns its dead, while a third eats its dead. Pick your choose, which way you wanna be. All right, the second argument is that, or the premises is that, therefore there is no objective truth in morality. Right and wrong are matters of opinion, and opinions vary from cultures to culture. I'm sure you might have heard of these arguments before. First is that different cultures have different moral codes, and therefore there are no objective truth in morality. But there's a problem in this argument. The second doesn't follow from the first, right? There is no, second looks like a conclusion that someone has drawn from the first premises. It breaks all the laws of logic when you talk about an argument. So CR, or cultural relativism, depends on two theses. First is the dependency thesis, which says that morality inherently depends on cultural factors and no other factors. There is no objective realm. The culture determines the moral standards and sensibility just as much as it determines what language to be spoken. There's no much difference between them. And the other is that about diversity thesis. If all morality is dependent on culture, and if cultures differ, then morality will differ from culture to culture, which is true. If these statements are true, the conclusion does come, right? If morality is derived from culture, then cultures are different. Then morality has to be different. But we are going to present an argument against that. So there are six claims that are made under CR. First one, different societies have different moral codes. Second, there is no objective standard by which one can judge one code better than the other. The third is, a particular moral code has no special status. It is merely one among many other codes. There is no universal truth in ethics which holds for all people at all times. And third one, which is more of a definition, it says a society's moral code determines what is right and what is wrong in the society. This is the gist of CR. It is the society that determines what is right and what is wrong. And sixth, it shows arrogance to judge the conduct of other cultures or society. That's how it is put forward before people. So the claim is, cultural relativism is a better explanation of social diversity than is moral objectivism. There are different cultures, so different, or cultural relativism actually explains social diversity. And it goes along with the slogan that the truth is local. What is true here is true for this place. What is true for other country or other group of people or other group of, you know, other society is true for them, but not for us here. So what are the consequences? If you are a cultural relativist, you have to believe in these things. One is, we cannot say that the practice of other cultures are morally inferior to ours. You would never be able to say that if you hold to CR. Second, we can decide if actions are right or wrong simply based on standards or approvals of our society. So there is a sort of presupposition here that you have to obey your society that you are in or the culture you are in. So who are you going to depend on? Sometimes society depends on people like philosophers of the time. Sometimes they depend on their politicians. Sometimes they depend on their educators. But they have to depend on someone to dictate what is right. And I want to read this, what Scott Ray, one of the professors at Biola, said. Morality does need cultural acceptance to function properly, which is true, we all agree. Any morality that is dictated has to be accepted by the society. It is quite another thing to insist that cultural acceptance determines the validity of its value. That's where we go wrong. It's not the culture that determines the value or the validity of the value. And the third is that you can't hold to an objective moral progress. We will talk about this a little more in a while. You can't sing the song, change the world. Change for what? For good or for bad? Because nothing is good or bad. right? What you are today is good, so why you have to even change to become better? So the argument goes like this: value differ from culture to culture, whereas there's a presupposition there, this argument that one should always obey the culture in which he lives. Okay? Without that presupposition, you can't implement CR. So I'll just give one example out from here. Won't be discussing everything because we don't have much time here. So do we have enough grounds to actually say that these practices are wrong? I come from India, and in India, before 1850, when this practice was actually banned, there was a tradition where, a widow had to actually jump on her husband's pyre, burning pyre, and kill herself. It was called sati, right? And if we see in what ground actually we can say that that was wrong, if cultural relativism is right, if that's what we need to adopt. Do we have ground to say that we were doing wrong back in India then? No. And Britishers were actually wrong in banning that legally. There's no basis to say that. How is cannibalism wrong if it is adopted by any culture? On what basis can we say that they are wrong and we are right under CR? Or how is murder right or wrong? It is Alistair McGrath, who was my professor at Oxford University. He said that it is utterly wrong-headed to say that something is true for you, but not for me. For example, what if I should think fascism is true, and you think that liberal democracy is equally true? Should the fascist repression be tolerated by the believer in liberal democracy? If not, on what grounds? He's asking that same question. Why not permit Stalinism or Satanism or Nazism without criteria to determine truth? This relativism fails miserably. Let me come to, I may have to jump to the objections that are there against cultural relativism. Let me wait for you to find, what slide number is it? Can you see? 12, slide, yeah. 17? Page number 17? Okay. Page number 17? Let's see some of the objections that are there against cultural relativism. While it is said that every culture is different, it's overstated. At the same time, there is something that is understated, that there are moral consensus as well. What about those? You go anywhere around the world, any culture, any country, there are certain moral consensus. And no one agreed upon those. You know, they didn't have a meeting of nations coming together and saying that we are going to agree on these moral issues. They didn't do that, right? So how is it that there are certain moral consensus regardless of where you go? It is Clyde Lucan who said that every culture has a concept of murder, distinguishing this from execution, killing in war and other justifiable homicides, the notion of incest, and other regulations upon sexual behavior, the prohibitions on untruth under defined circumstances of restitution and reciprocity, of mutual obligations between parents and children. These and many other moral concepts are altogether universal. Doesn't matter where you go, they may look in different ways in terms of practice, but the basic core idea is universal. Now, CR, cultural relativism, does not provide a way to arbitrate among competing cultural value claims. You can't make a proclamation, universal proclamation. You know, if I ask any American here today, do you think slavery is good? What will be the answer? There'll be few, I'm sure. I do hear about those people who would say, no, we can't make, especially in academia, who would say, we can't make a value judgment whether it's right or wrong. But if I ask, majority of people would say, we will make a universal. And does it matter whether slavery happens here in America or somewhere in African countries or somewhere in Eastern countries? We would still say, no, it's wrong. How do we do that? You know? And that's never discussed when we talk about CR. So And who defines which is the relevant society or culture? Who is it who says that this is a culture that can actually say something is right or wrong? Suppose, for example, and this is an example given by J.P. Moreland in his book, Love Your God with All Your Mind. He says, suppose there's a man who is in, who's from society A, and he is into extramarital affair and, you know, sexual affair, and he goes to society B and finds a woman from there and goes to society C where the hotel is, right? So how should he be judged? On what basis? If the society A, B, C disagree on this issue, which society should he, you know, follow when it comes to moral standards? And how is he going to be, you know, prosecuted? On what basis? If society B says that it's okay to do that, it's permissible, right? So what happens when we belong to different or multiple societies? Can we have different value systems? No. There is this is and ought fallacy when we talk about CR. Just because something is the practice does not mean it ought to be. All right? Someone is practicing something, it might be the case that it ought to be like that, but that's not the case always. Many of the observations of moral diversity were differences in moral practices. We should not merge those categories together. Now, something called reformer's dilemma, I don't know how many of you have heard of this one. There is something called reformer's dilemma. Moral reformers are members of a society who stand outside that society's code and pronounce a need for reform and change in that code. So according to CR, Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi, or anybody else, any reformer, they are morally corrupt or morally wrong. Because they stepped out of the moral code of the time and wanted some sort of reform. If they were doing that, then according to CR, they are morally corrupt. So there is this dilemma under this case. Now, we already discussed about this a bit, so I'm not going to go through this. And Harry is going to talk about this after me on tolerance. But this is what is being sold to us. What is said? What is the argument that is against us is this, that transcendent moral principles encourages intolerance and dogmatism, right? So the problem with this argument is that cultural relativism does not have a basis to justify tolerance as a universal moral principle. Should you say that everyone should be tolerant all over the world, then you are making a universal moral judgment. You're cutting yourself. I mean, it's self-defeating. You can't sit on the branch that which you're cutting. You will definitely fall. That's a saying in India, by the way. This is what Dr. Deweys and Moreland say. The refusal to make a judgment about the morality of an action is not genuine tolerance. It's moral cowardice or intellectual laziness or plain confusion. I like it. And we have to stand our ground always when this argument is brought against us that we are not tolerant. Yes, we are not tolerant to foolishness. Harry is going to talk about it, so I'm not going to get much into it. Let me go further. All because of this issue of tolerance, many nations have used cultural relativism as a justification for limiting the rights in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Countries like Iran, Pakistan, you know, they have different standards the way their culture functions. Now, all because of CR, they have sought some sort of justification to go the way they were going. They wanted some sort of approval, and our society will have to give if we believe in CR. Some may say that it is about going a little extreme, but I don't think so. This can happen. This tendency is possible. Moral anarchy. It is an unstable position and has tendency to reduce ultimate to moral anarchy. Under it, it is not possible to give a non-question begging definition of culture. What constitutes a relevant culture? Some of the examples are, here in our country, here in America, if I may say our country, the Supreme Court held that community standards are relevant when considering what constitutes pornography. Or is it based on a single state? like prostitution is legal in Nevada, or a region, the South prior to Civil War, would have regarded slavery as moral, or what the whole nation thinks about it, or the Western world thinks about what is right and wrong. If we boil it down, it comes down to this, those who agree. So if we have a majority on an issue, that is what the culture thinks. That is what is right and what is wrong. So if you pronounce something that which looks evil today, but majority is behind it, it can be approved. So why is it popular? We have to be very much cautious. First of all, we have to see, when we see any issue in the culture, whether it's some sort of bias dressed up in moral language, like slavery era, the Civil War era, where some were justifying, right, slavery. It was a sort of bias that was dressed up in moral language. Second, false dichotomy between relativist and absolutist. One can be what is called a prima facie absolutist, if that's how it is pronounced, sorry, literally, at first appearance. While recognizing the importance of an unchanging objective moral principles, the prima facie absolutist, is that right? Absolutist allows for periodic exceptions to general principles. So what's happening here is that we are always being blamed that we are going the other extreme, right? But that's not the case. There are cases where we, like say for example, if someone comes to my house at night and threatens me, right? Should I respond to that or not? Right? Whether I should or not. Or should I say that because I say that murder is wrong or fighting is wrong, I should hold back and let that person do whatever they want to? No. So we don't go that extreme always. We make value judgments according to situations sometimes. So there is a middle path always. We do hold on to the absolute view about truth, that there is such a thing. But that's not the case always. It sounds humble. So when I say that, you know, I'm tolerant, it sounds very much humble. It appeals to people. It is easy. We don't have to be critical about other cultures, other traditions. And sometimes it's also an overreaction to ignorance. Because we don't understand other, like say for example, there are cultures whom we don't understand well and we have not studied well about them. So we say that they are good. So they are just like us. And so out of ignorance that we overreact. And sometimes it sounds sophisticated, especially in academia. It's all about being open-minded, you know, being very much inclusive. We don't have to be exclusive. It looks evil. We got to be inclusive. And then it promotes tolerance or accommodation. We saw the example of what has happened in England through the Church of England. So what is our first priority? This is what C.S. Lewis said. When a ship goes onto high seas, it has to answer three questions. How to keep from sinking, how to keep from bumping into other ships, and the most important of all those is, why is it out there in the first place, right? The first is a personal ethics. The second is social ethics. But the third is the most essential one, and it's essential ethics. What is life's purpose? Unless we answer that most important question, where do we get our purpose from, our meaning from, our values from, what determines what is good and right, and how are we going to apply that from our own personal life and in our society comes from that. So we have to first of all, this is the first priority, that we answer the essential ethics. This is what, I'm going to quote two atheists here. How much time do we have? 10 minutes? Okay, thank you. All right. J.L. Mackey said this. We might well argue that objective, intrinsically prescriptive features supervenient upon natural ones constitute so odd a cluster of qualities and relations that they are unlikely to have arisen in the ordinary course of events without an all-powerful God to create them. We definitely need an all-powerful God to give us that kind of standard by which we can define what is right and wrong. It was Louis Anthony who said, any argument against the objective reality of moral values will be based on premises that are less obvious than the existence of objective moral values themselves. So what she is saying is that the existence of objective moral values are more obvious. But atheists would have a problem to follow such objective moral values, because they want to deny the very existence of God from where the values come. So as Christians, what do we do? Absoluteness is a distinctive characteristic of evangelical ethics. This absolute basis for morality is grounded on the belief in an infinitely perfect God who wills men to be good in accordance with unchanging perfection of his own nature. Matthew chapter 5, verses 48 says, you therefore must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. Not like as your culture is perfect, not like your church is perfect, or your pastor is perfect, or your teacher is perfect. You should be perfect as the heavenly Father is perfect. Romans 2, 14 and 15, we read, the works of laws are written on their hearts. So by virtue of being God's creatures, we have a sense of morality within us, regardless of where we come from, right? So let me jump to so what is our thesis as Christians? I'm borrowing it from J.P. Morgan, and he says this very well. It includes almost everything that we can talk about when it comes to cultural relativism. The Christian doctrine of general revelation and the idea of natural moral law, notion that there are true universally binding moral principles knowable by all people and rooted in creation and the way things are made, lead us to suspect at least some widespread agreement about moral values. And the biblical doctrine of original sin should lead us to suspect that cultures can become morally twisted. That's what has happened. That's what is our thesis. Why are some cultures different and doesn't look morally good? It's because of original sin, right? I believe firmly cultures, we're not saying that cultures are bad, but we are saying cultures are at different level. There are better cultures, there are good cultures, but there are cultures that need to actually step onto that point. And he goes on to say that, okay, and the biblical doctrine of original sin should lead us to suspect that cultures can become morally twisted and repugnant depending on the degree to which that culture lives and thinks in light of general or special revelation. So what are we saying? The source of objective moral values, where do we get it from? For us, God provides the only objective standard for moral values. And not just that, he also provides the only transcendent authority for enforcing the oughtness of moral duties. As C.S. Lewis said, you can't, I'm paraphrasing him, you can't say a stick is crooked unless you have an idea of what a straight stick looks like. So where do we get that idea, that standard from? As Christians, we firmly believe that it comes from God himself. So what has happened in our culture, in our generation? Reason has replaced revelation. But this is not something new. We see this in the very Garden of Eden, when the serpent asks, did God really say it? And there we go, started using our reason. Now here we are, we want to become like God, right? When Pilate was before Christ, what is truth? And he didn't stay even there. And he left because he knows he has his own standard of truth and he doesn't want to confront with the truth of Christ. And that's what's happening in our culture today. But do we choose to say yes, is the question for us. C.S. Lewis said, it is in man's power to treat himself as a mere natural object and his judgments of value as raw materials for scientific manipulation to alter at will. The real objection is that if man chooses to treat himself as raw material he will be. Not raw material to be manipulated as he fondly imagined, but by himself, but by mere appetite, that is mere nature, in the person of his dehumanized conditioners. A dogmatic belief in objective value is necessary, the very idea of a rule which is not tyranny or an obedience which is not slavery. How much time do we have? 2 more minutes? Okay. Yeah. Let me share this case. I don't know how many of you read about this today. The Mozilla case. You know what Mozilla is, right? The Firefox thing. The CEO of that organization had to resign today. Why? Because he gave $1,000 to a group of people who were against Prop 8 in California. But this is the statement that the organization made, and I want to read it for you to help you understand what kind of culture that we are in today. Here it goes. We didn't act like we would expect Mozilla to act. We didn't move fast enough to engage with people once the controversy started. We are sorry, we must do better. Brendan Eich, if I'm pronouncing his name right, has chosen to step down from his role as CEO. He's made this decision for Mozilla and our community. Mozilla believes both in equality and freedom of speech. Equality is necessary for meaningful speech, and you need free speech to fight for equality. Now, see, figuring out how to stand for both at the same time can be hard. That's where we have reached. That's what they are saying. Keeping free speech and equality, we're finding it difficult now. Why? Because there is multiple speech now, and we have approved everything in the same light. No matter what you say, right? But now, in the name of equality, what has happened? Everyone is equal. Everyone, no matter what view hold, where you come from, everyone is equal. But this person who resigned has no free speech. Where did his equality go? I have no idea. He had to resign. Lastly, to finish, let me say this. There is, and I found this online. I have the quote, actually, it's in, the footnote is missing from here, but it's there in my notes. And it is said very well. There is little safety left on a planet that surrenders its individual responsibility to collective and foregoes any duty to fulfill one's natural purpose. The progressive slope that society proceeds upon only demeans the whole. Abandoning the quest for universal ethics denies our instinctive intuition. In order to fulfill our nature as a rational creature, humanity must believe that rightful moral principles are ubiquitously applicable. I want to finish with that. I hope you had a good treat, as he said, but treat of good Indian accent. Well, thank you so much for giving me this time. Thank you, Jeremy. I really forgot I should have said something. You can throw questions to me, but they'll be fielded by these two experts here. against other faiths and beliefs? Yeah. Can I start with the second one? One thing that we have, in my observation, that we have failed to do is put forward our case confidently. You know, Christ is the content of, or the object of our faith, right? We can't exclude that when we're talking about faith. But there is something called we have to do it with boldness. We have failed to do that. And let me give you some examples. Having stayed in UK for some time, I've seen there people are attracted to mainly Islam. The reason is why? Because they're looking for something credible, that something that people are passionate about. So I'm not saying that you have to make up passion, no. If we know that it's true, we will present it with passion. But we should not be intimidated by thinking that we will offend the other person. Believe me, in my experience, whenever I have been truthful, whenever I've been genuine in sharing my faith, people are drawn to listen to the message that we have. The time when we are not confident and bold enough to present what we have, we consider as valuable, why do you think they will consider us valuable? That's one thing. What kept me in my faith? Two things. First of all, I would say God's providence, first of all. He is the one who attracts us to himself. He is the one who sustains us. Could have gone other ways? Yes. So the argument that Richard Dawkins says, that you come from a country, say a Hindu country, so you should be Hindu. Here I am, a Christian from a Hindu country, right? So how did that happen? As I said, I was privileged to be born in a Christian family. So I had an upbringing where my parents did inculcate Christian values in me. But let me say, that's not what kept me. Because I know of friends who've been Christians, who had similar kind of environment, but they left. All right, they went the other way. So it can happen. For me, it had been a personal quest. Let me share a little bit of my journey. I've had the privilege of traveling to other places, right? Being involved with other cultures and see them and engage with them. So my faith gradually grew, I would say. It wasn't a spontaneous thing, right? For me, it was definitely an investigation. There are three things that attracted me to Christianity. And these are the three things that we always fail to present before people. And I know my answer is too long, but let me... these three things, and this is what makes us exclusive. This is what makes us unique and beautiful. Our idea of who God is. We serve a God, right? Who is, we've always, you know, hesitate to talk about a triune God. But I think that's the most powerful thing that we have. It's not something that we could create or make up. It was revealed to us in the scriptures, and we see it, right, in the character of Christ himself. How is it important? But we all, regardless of what culture you go to, we all talk about love, right? How can you talk about a love that comes from an impersonal God? That won't happen under Hinduism. How can you talk about love if it comes from a monad, just one God? As Islam, in Islam they would say, Allah is one, but in the sense that he is not three persons, as we believe in. He's not three God, he's one God as we believe, but there is love within the community of Trinity. He didn't need us to love us, right? He didn't need to create us. He's eternally loving. There's love between Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, eternally. So we have a God who loves. So this idea of God, and the second is being made in the image of God, right? This nation that we are in today was founded on this principle, that we all are equal, right? It was written at a time when no one was treated equal, especially, right? There was slavery at that point of time. But what were the founders saying? I'm not the same with you. I look different. I speak in a different accent. I come from a different place. How are we equal? What is it equal in us? Other than the image of God. That's the second thing. The image of God. You remove the image of God, we are not equal. Why should we even care about each other? Why should we even... I was into international development. This is the question that brought me into apologetics and theology. We were so busy concern about what projects to do. We would go to Africa and think about what projects to do and how to do it. But no one was asking the primary question, why should we even care to do it? Right? I said, no, that's where we should be starting. And unless you have a God who has made us in his image, and when I go and serve someone who is not so privileged, what I'm doing is that respecting God's image in them, right? Fulfilling God's commission. And the third is the resurrection of Christ. And Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 15, if you can actually, you know, say resurrection didn't happen, our faith is in vain. That's it. Is Christianity falsifiable? Just prove that resurrection didn't happen. And Christianity is falsified. So those three things. But it is God's grace, and also questioning all these things, and I found that Christian faith was exclusive. Purely exclusive. Unlike any other religion. Right? And how it has... And, okay, I don't have much time. I'll talk to you individually. Yeah? What we should be doing, I'm very optimistic when it comes to how culture can, you know, go ahead. Why? Because I believe it's a promise that Christ gave. I will build my church. It is his responsibility, right? Church is not going to be affected in any way. I'm not saying that it won't be persecuted, but it will stay. It will, right, continue regardless of what. Here in the Western world, persecution looks in this way now, and we are questioning it now. So what should we be doing? I think this is exactly what we should be doing here. And not just that, when we step out from here, we have to find and prepare people and position them in places, because those who are defining culture today are in minority, believe it or not. Majority doesn't want it. Majority of Americans or people around the world doesn't want some of the things that's been implemented in their culture. It's the minority. Why? Because they're positioned at a place where they can actually define what culture looks like. And we are into pressure then to give into those things. So if you ask me personally, I think that's the strategy. First of all, we prepare ourselves and prepare people around us to position themselves. There are seven mountains, you know. I think it was Lance Armstrong who's not Neil Armstrong, Lance Armstrong, who said, who talks about business, media, education, family, church, media, education. Seven mountains. This is what, if you have people there who can actually dictate, you know, things that are biblical, if I may put it that way, that which are right, has always been right, especially in this culture, based on Judeo-Christian values on which it was founded, we can definitely influence. But depending on the Holy Spirit, for sure, because he has to guide the process. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeremy. You guys hear me okay?
All right.
So that was like drinking from a fire hydrant. So that's going to be hard to top, Jacob. I wish I'd gone first, but anyways. But I'm going to start this tradition. I gave this talk about a month ago at Canada, at a church there. We had a conference, and I started it by having a selfie. All right, so we're going to do that. All right, everybody, we're going to do this. Everybody, get in there. One, two. All right. That's awesome. I'm gonna tag you guys. Okay, so let's see. How do we start this important thing here? Number one, I just want to say that, again, I'm Harry Edwards, and apologetics.com started as a project in my MA in apologetics at Biola. I figured that instead of writing a thesis or whatever, that I would work on something that would last beyond me. So that's forming a nonprofit organization. So we are a 501c3, and we're small. We're, believe it or not, all volunteers. That's not the goal. But we are all volunteers. And like Jeremy said, we've been doing it for 15 years. And, you know, I guess I figured the rewards will be in heaven. But we are working to not make it volunteers. So I say that because we covet your prayers. We can do a lot more if we were full-time. Somebody asked, you know, I detected a couple things from you guys asking, so what do we do now, right? And I really want to focus on that. That's my thing. That's my style. I want to get practical and hopefully challenge one another on this. The title of this is not unique. I borrowed it from D.A. Carson's book, just FYI. I'm merely a pointer to good stuff, so this is it. A lot of what I'm saying is based on this. And this guy right here, Oz Guinness, he's become a good friend, and he wrote The Case for Civility. So I would recommend these two books, D.A. Carson and Oz Guinness. And I have a feeling that both of them don't agree 100%, but it's okay, I think. Sure, but I might need that back, though. two good books. And you know what else I found out? You can't copyright titles. So I'm okay borrowing it. I'm gonna use it for my own because it's. I tried being creative, but I can't be more creative than that. Here's what Oz Guinness said about the state we're in. The facts are on the table. The stakes are high, and the moment of opportunity is closing. Unless the present generation restores civility in public life, the American Republic will decline. Okay. We have some goals for tonight. And the last time I did this, it was I did it back-to-back, and it was, believe it or not, exactly 45 minutes. I'll see if I can speed up and end in like 30 minutes because I want some Q&A. I want some questions and answers. Okay. Obviously, we're going to stick around and talk some more after this formal session is over, but I'll be watching the time pretty closely. So our goals are pretty straightforward. We're going to define tolerance / intolerance. We're going to provide some examples of what those are. And this third point, we might dwell long on this. I'm calling it the I'm calling it the pointers to consider. It's maybe concepts or words or whatever that maybe we've not really talked about inside the church, but I think is very valuable if we're going to engage culture. So we're going to dwell on that. And it might be more of a like a bullet point type stuff. It might be all over the place, but hopefully you're able to use it in a comprehensive way. Bless you. And hopefully it'll add to your vocabulary. I'm hoping that it'll be valuable to you guys to help clarify some things. And then, see, I put it here on my slide, right? Discuss some practical ways to address our challenges. I love practical stuff. I love laying out the challenges to cause you to grow more, expand your thinking, and just stretch together, right? And then we'll have some time for Q&A. I do want to say, though, I have some disclaimers that I want to say. So this is like an international meeting, right? So you have Jacob from India. I'm from the Philippines. I consider still, you know, the Philippines a big part of my life, even though I've been here a long time, more here than the Philippines. But I say that because, just like Jacob, I feel like I have a special sensitivity to culture. I feel like I can switch from world one to world two, whatever it is. I feel blessed by that, but in the beginning, I thought it was a curse because internally I was confused, you know, in my identity. But now I guess God's using that for things like these. So I appreciate it. And I'll even make statements later that for most of, you know, maybe people living in just one culture, they feel embarrassed, right? They can't say, oh, this culture is better than the other. Well, I'm telling you right now, that's totally true. Some cultures are better than others, all right? I'll just say, I'd say Amish is better than Nazism, right? It's a simple thing. All right, so those are some of the disclaimers. And I think I just messed with this, Jacob. How do I? Oh, there you go. It's still working. Okay, so let's see. What else are some of my disclaimers? This is addressed to Christians for the most part. Okay, I'm speaking to Christians, to believers. However, I need to keep in mind that this message is also for unbelievers. So I want to not be so biased that way because the message is for them as well. So when I'm talking, you can just remember I'm trying to keep that balance. Because a lot of this stuff needs to take place between believers and unbelievers. Also, because this is an apologetics type of a thing, I'm not a political expert, so we're not gonna go there. It's not gonna be a session on politics. However, even as I say that, I want you to know if in your mind you're thinking this is, you know, there's anything political about this, that as a body that we should not be intimidated by politics. So think of politics, and I was just bouncing this off of Jacob a while ago. Think of politics the way I think of it, which is just applied ethics. And you heard a lot about what Jacob was saying. It's a great foundation for what I'm going to share tonight. If politics is just applied ethics, then when we think of something that's political, just switch and go, all right, what's right and what's wrong? That's all you have to do. What's right, what's wrong here? You know, how do we advance the cause of society? So that's all you have to do. So even as I say that, I hope that we become more engaged in politics. Because all it is doing what's right. You know, distinguishing between right and wrong. Politicians, on the other hand, that's a different subject, right? But I think ideas, like for instance, abortion is a great subject that many call political. But what does that really mean, right? When we're thinking, and why can't we discuss that at church? Well, see, that's the thing, because we think if it's politics, we shut down. But if we think that If we think right away that it's a way to think about what's right and what's wrong about this, then somehow it becomes okay, right? But that really is what it is. Slavery, right? Political? Well, I don't think so. Or it encompasses both. So why can't we behave in those kinds of ways on the political sphere and also on the moral sphere? It's the same thing. So I say all this because when you think it's political, don't be intimidated. We need to engage, period. So that's one disclaimer. Another thing, lastly, I want to say, we probably might not all agree on the solutions that I present in my last slide, but that's okay. We can talk more about that. And that's it's like an exercise in what we're trying to get at here. And I do welcome your feedback. Right? But I'm going to guess that we'll agree most of the time. How about that? Okay, so let's define this thing here. That's our first goal, right? So the Oxford English Dictionary says to tolerate is to endure, to sustain, what else? To allow to exist or to be done or practiced without authoritative interference, or molestation, to allow, permit, to bear without repugnance, to allow intellectually or in taste, sentimental or principle, to put up with, right? So far, so good. I think we can all agree with that. Let's see, Webster's, that's supposed to be Webster's. It's to allow, permit, not interfere with, to recognize and respect others' beliefs, practices, etc., without necessarily agreeing or sympathizing. So far, so good. To put up with, there's a common theme again, right? To put up with, as he tolerates his brother-in-law, you know, something like that, as an example. Or, you know, you have a certain toleration for medicine, right? So far, so good. Here's one, encarta, accept existence of different views, okay? To recognize other people's right to have different beliefs or practices without an attempt to suppress them. So far, so good. That is the, we'll call that the old way of thinking of tolerance. Now, there's a slight nuance when we come to the verb tolerance, or the noun tolerance, also in the same source. It says the accepting of the different views of other people, for example, in religious or political matters, and fairness toward the people who hold these different views. So if you didn't catch the difference there, I try to make it more obvious. The first one, right, the one we've been defining, the old definition of tolerance says accept the existence of different views, to accept the existence of different views. The second one, you guys notice the nuance? It's a difference, right? Acceptance of different views. Interesting. You just take out the existence part. There's a world of difference. World of difference. Scary, right? It's scary difference. Okay, so, well, what do they mean? So let's give some examples here. So if Sally, she is a very tolerant person, let's say, is the meaning that she gladly puts up with a lot of opinions with which she disagrees, or is the meaning she thinks all opinions are equally valid? Okay. Again, if we're mixing the whole idea of tolerance and tolerance, what does she mean? Or how about this one? We do not, a Muslim cleric might say, we do not tolerate other religions, right? Is the Muslim saying that he thinks other religions are permitted to exist? You know, do Muslims, don't they think that other religions are permitted to exist? Or Muslims cannot agree that other religions are as valid as Islam? Okay, so there's a difference there, right? One is he's saying that other religions are not permitted to exist, versus he just doesn't know if others are as valid as Islam. How about this? A Christian pastor might say, Christians gladly tolerate other religions. Does he mean that Christians gladly insist that their religions have as much right to exist as Christianity does? Or does he mean that Christians gladly assert that all religions are equally valid? Okay. You've heard this before, right? You Christians are so intolerant. Well, what do they mean by that? Does this mean that Christians wish all positions contrary to our own be eliminated or destroyed? Or do we mean that Christians insist that Jesus is the only way to God? So, in the old sense, we are being tolerant. But in the new sense, apparently, we are not being tolerant. And it's always hard to keep those two things together. So never mind the self-defeating nature of this. All right, which we will talk about, but. It's even very confusing. Okay, that's the thing. We'll talk about how this is self-refuting to begin with, but it is confusing. If anything, we can start there. It's very confusing. I want to give some examples here, and I didn't know that you had a lot of time spent in Manchester. So kind of cool. It's kind of cool that I picked this one. But in 2005, a cooperative bank based in Manchester, England, actually refused or decided to remove or decided to discontinue a Christian organization's account because the organization's views apparently were incompatible with the position of the bank. Okay? And this is what the bank said. It has come to the bank's attention that Christian Voice is engaged in discriminatory pronouncements based on the grounds of sexual orientation. This public stance is incompatible with the position of the cooperative bank, which publicly supports diversity and dignity in all its forms for our staff, customers, and other stakeholders. We accept that everyone has the right to freedom of thought on religion. However, we do not believe that this entitles people to actively encourage and practice discrimination. So apparently, religious views are okay if it's kept private, okay? So long as you don't enact on them. But see, don't we discriminate all the time, though? Think about it. Don't we discriminate all the time? For instance, we're not going to hire someone who's been convicted of a sexual crime to run our Sunday school department, right? We're not going to do that. Or I'm not, even though as educated as some of you guys are, I'm not going to have you guys fly planes, right? I mean, you need certain knowledge for that. So we do discriminate all the time in our jobs. How about this one? This is an interesting one. So in 2007, Donald Hindley, who is a sociologist professor at Brandeis University, he was lecturing on some, you know, like on the subject of Mexican immigration. And he made reference to a term that was used pejoratively, I guess, of them. And he mentioned the term wetback. Now, I mean, that was a pejorative term, and he was just merely saying that this was a fact. In fact, 1954, Eisenhower, when he was attempting to repatriate about a million Mexicans, he called the operations Operation Wetback. Now, you can look that up. That's exactly what happened. So this professor just simply mentioned that, like I'm mentioning it to you now. Well, a couple of his students, they complained, and they complained that he was being that he's being intolerant, that he was being you know, exercising or doing hateful speech by doing that. Well, the sad part was the university did impose a classroom monitor on him to ensure that his speech was never out of line, all without granting him a formal hearing. You know, it's those kinds of weird things. Just the mere mention of the fact. You know, he was just, and he had been an upstanding professor for like 30-something years, no complaints whatsoever, until that day in 2007. Very interesting. I'm sure you guys are aware of the Hippocratic Oath. It's that formal thing where doctors to be raise their right hand and they promise to save life and they uphold, you know, the values of humanity and all that. Well, until recently, some of these conscience clauses that has been protected is now being challenged because, as you know, if culture says abortion is okay, and let's say the government says that it is legal, then if you're a doctor, I suppose you are obligated to perform those things. But like I said, there are conscience clauses, but my reading recently says indicates that that is beginning to disappear. So that is a terrible, terrible thing. Now doctors can't just opt out of that. So we might see a day when people might bring lawsuits on doctors just because they refuse to perform things that they feel violates their conscience. So very, very troubling. So again, nothing new. I think we've all kind of encountered some of these things in the news, at work, during discussions and everything. So what I want to do is I just want to go into my next slide here. Pointers to consider. And at this part of my presentation, I just want to give out some ideas there to think about that I feel will help us engage this topic. So let's go with this one. Spheres of influence. We all know about God, Caesar, all right? God being God, Caesar being the state, or God, you know, religion, Caesar, the state. And I don't know if we've considered the family as one of these big spheres of influence or spheres of power. I think that is something that we need to focus on a little bit. Think about it. The citizens that make any culture or government, how are they raised to that? Well, they all come from families, don't they? Right. So if you think about it, if you think that our culture is in decline, do you think that the government was so powerful that they changed culture just like that? Yeah, I don't think so. Yeah, you guys are saying no. So something happened in the family. So do you think schools are really that powerful that they can steer an entire generation to be kind of where we are right now? See, I don't think so. I don't think it starts with the family. So again, so we've got God, obviously God, you know, that's an obvious thing. Caesar being state. Yeah, those two are very powerful. But we can't neglect the family. Think about the influence that the family brings. So if you're a parent, consider your position as the same level as those two things. In fact, God does say to parents that we are in charge of our kids, right? So, again, so if you think our culture is kind of like in decline, well, sure, we can blame God. Sure, we can blame the state. But let's not forget, we can blame ourselves to the family, okay? We can blame the family. How about negative and positive rights? How many of you have heard of this? Okay, so, good. I get a lot of this from J.P. Moreland. I think you mentioned J.P. Moreland in your talk as well. But we need to also understand the difference between negative and positive rights and how it plays into this conversation. So, a negative right is a right for me to be protected from harm if I try to get something for myself. Okay, try to let that sit for a while. Again, a negative right is a right for me to be protected from harm if I try to get something for myself. As opposed to a positive right, this is easy to remember, it's just a right for something to be provided for me. That's how you make the distinction. So, for example, if you think health care is a negative right, then you're thinking that the government should protect you and not get in the way of you trying to obtain that. Okay, so if we feel that healthcare is a negative right, again, then the state has an obligation to keep people from preventing me from getting health care and discriminating against me, if it is a negative right. If it is a positive right, if health care is a positive right, then we expect the government to provide that for me. Do you see the difference? Okay. Where are we with Obamacare, right? Okay, so anyways, again, maybe there's that political flavor in there. But it is obvious that our society is leaning toward positive rights, right? So it's just something, you know, some conversational type things to consider. You know, if you feel someone is saying this and that is so entitled, then you could say, you must believe in positive rights, right? Versus negative rights. I know J.P. Moreland, I didn't know this, but J.P. Moreland, who teaches at Biola University, actually has an article. If you want, we can connect and I can send you that article. He actually argues for which political party decide on. He thinks that one is better than the other, that one is actually biblical than the other. So you won't find a lot of people who will try to make that case. But anyways, and you won't be surprised. I know, it's so bad, right? So bad. All right. How about this? Separation of church and state. It's a popular term, very popular term. But we need to remember that it is, there's a distinction versus a strict separation. So while those two are indeed separate, we should not lean too heavily on the strict separation. It's okay to have them distinct, but they are not totally separate. I know Os Guinness, again, I'll just mention his view on this, and I love him as a brother. And if you think about it a while, you might actually come to agree with him. But he thinks that school prayer, that it was right that it got banned. I know. Wow. You know. Yeah. Also, Os Guinness does believe that school, it was right that the government said no school prayer. Because think about it. If you adhere to the concept of one in, all in, okay, one in, all in, which means if we're going to be tolerant and we're going to love everybody, and everybody, you know, can sit at the table type of a thing and have their religions all there. Then maybe on Monday you have the Hindu prayer. Tuesday you might have the Muslim prayer. And then, you know, until you get maybe Wednesday, we might have the Christian prayer. Then we would have all of these kind of religions all at the same time, maybe one day each. Now you can imagine how confusing that would be. So he advocates for one out, all out type of a thing. So just no prayers. However, as Os Guinness would say, it doesn't mean that you can't have Christian groups have their meeting after school and all that, you know, after school programs. Obviously, freedom of speech is there, is protected. So yeah, I mean, raise issues in the classroom. But to have, I think in his mind, to have a government sanction thing, it's probably a good idea to not get into. So there you have the whole separation of church and state acting out. Because, I mean, think about it too, right? Again, we are a predominantly a Christian a community. Our government and our founding fathers are all theists and everything. Well, can you imagine if we don't have a strict separation, or we don't have some kind of separation? What if we become all Muslim? Like in the Muslim country, in your experience, there is no separation of church and state. So the church and the state are all Muslims. Their laws are all Sharia laws and everything. You can't, if it goes against your religion, you can't just penetrate it. So I don't know which one's better, right? I don't know. So anyways, that's something to think about. How about tolerant of people but not ideas might be a good way to think about it. We are commanded to be loving and to be patient with one another. But when it comes to ideas, that's a whole different matter. In fact, one prominent politician said, "We're all entitled to our opinions, but not the facts." I like that. Yeah. So a fact is a fact, right? But sure, we can ruminate all we want. We can have opinions here and there, but facts are facts. And I remember this one was more of a personal thing, hypocrisy. How do we deal with that? Because don't we... We want to live according to our deep core convictions. We all want to do that. So when we say we want to tolerate someone's view, we are saying that we are allowing it to exist. You know, I tolerate you, which actually says we disagree, or I think you're wrong, but I'm going to be patient with you. I'll tolerate you. So I remember even personally struggling with that because I had some crazy ideas. In fact, the whole separation of church and state, I'm thinking a perfect society should be really just a Christian society and that's it. So, and that would be pretty intolerant, in other words. In other words, if you were to immigrate to my ideal country, you'd have to be a Christian. And that's probably not practical, and then probably Christianity's not going to grow, you know, unless maybe I'm sending missionaries out there. But anyways, so I realized that, let's say, in Romans 3:25 and Acts 17, even God is actually tolerant. You have that idea of God being tolerant. In those two passages I mentioned, there is the idea of God, his divine forbearance has allowed him to overlook old sins. That's what Scripture says. Or that he tolerated certain things for a while. Like Acts 17:30 talks about a time of ignorance that God overlooked. Okay, so there is that. So I go, all right, if God can be tolerant that way, I think I'm okay being tolerant that way, and that's true tolerance. Okay. So, what do we do? Here's what I think we need to do going forward. Number one, we need to expose the new tolerance's moral and epistemological bankruptcy. I know it's a big word, but you heard that from Jacob already, so it's his fault. Epistemology is just, it's how you know the things you know. How you come to know those things. So we already said that you can't have your cake and eat it too. I like that expression. That's a good expression, all right? You can't have your cake and eat it too. What does that mean? I mean, you hear that a lot, but pretty much you can't have it both ways. Truth has this amazing, pesky little thing that you run up against and it just bumps you in the head and you can't deny it. And this is a sad thing. I'm thinking of the president of World Vision last week when he says he's coming from a position of neutrality, right? He wants to be humble. He wants to be humble. So he's saying, all right, we accept same-sex marriages. They're legitimate in our organization. You heard the news, right? And then 24 hours later, he went back, said, no, I changed my mind on that. Well, he realized that 2,000 believers who know what's right said they're going to pull out their support and support another organization, all right? I want to make sure that's clear. It's not like we are so bad and so lacking of compassion, we're just going to let some kids die. No, they were pretty much everything I read, they were so disappointed at World Vision's decision that they're just going to pull out and then give it to another organization. So in terms of children needing to be clothed and taken care of, that's not changing. But I feel bad for World Vision. They just don't know what they've done. And again, all under the guise of wanting to be humble, wanting to be accepted. And it's hard for me to think that they really didn't consider the biblical view. Because that's what he was saying. That, oh, we didn't know, or we didn't mean to exclude the Christians. We want to remain true to biblical principles. They didn't consider that in the beginning. See, that's one of those areas I feel that's not debatable, actually. It's not even a gray area. So, again, you know where I stand on the whole homosexual issue. We're supposed to be loving them, obviously. Again, the whole tolerant of people, but not ideas. That's totally fine. See, a lot of these organizations that say we are intolerant, they unknowingly are unaware, they're just unaware that they too are being intolerant by claiming an exclusive view. Okay. So all we have to do is just point that out. That's all we have to do, just point it out. And I mentioned this already, that if the discussion becomes more of the cultural relativity type thing that Jacob was talking about, well, just say, you know, some cultures are actually bad. Some are better than others. And so our job is just to make distinctions, which ones are good, which ones are not so good. You know, being bicultural, I love how I can make those proclamations. And I'm okay, I feel it's totally obvious. Like in the Filipino culture, gossip is actually acceptable. Yeah, I know, it's weird. I've run this by some even good Christian people, and they had to think a while, and they go, yeah, I guess it's okay because it's cultural. No. Yeah, that's not good. Not good at all. Practice and encourage civility. Os Guinness is the champion of this, and in my personal relationship with him and even in his books, he really advocates for dialogue. Just so you know, that's a big part of what he's saying. Dialogue. Let's talk about these things. So, this is what we're doing. So we're talking about these things. It's kind of interesting when you read the news. It's amazing how 2 hours of talks between world leaders, and apparently that's enough to have wars or sanctions. It's amazing, right? I don't get that. Really? In just 2 hours of talk, or even an hour, actually. And that's it? With Os Guinness, I love his heart on that. It's really dialogue. Let's keep talking about these things. You can't talk it enough. And I'm going to say that we need to do more evangelization. And I have mentioned this before, but I think the new term for evangelism is apologetics. I really think that we need to be engaging in apologetics. If we're not doing apologetics in our culture, we're not evangelizing in today's culture. We are on the defensive, it seems like it. And people are asking the big questions. And a lot of this whole cultural relativity thing is a big part of this. I know that probably even in the 60s, Americans finally figured out, hey, you know, I thought we were on this way to the perfect society, and yet we had World War I, and then World War II, and then we had the Cold War. So we're not getting something right. So I understand that now they're saying, because we've been so arrogant, so let's scale back a little bit. But they've denied truth in the process. So that's not the right response. So anyways, we need to evangelize. We need to help people understand that you don't need to go to cultural relativism. All we have to do is correct our old system. That's fine. We can just reform. We can reform. Preserve a place for truth. ADC is like my short acronym for apologetics.com. So, yes, I am saying, why don't you imitate us? And this is what we're doing, okay? Here's one thing, couple things on that. Now, it's not like you have to form an organization, but one of the things that I love about our organization, and I make this a requirement, there's only one of two, but one of this is every month we need to come together and have dinner and just fellowship and talk about stuff. So that's what we do. Jeremy, Jacob, once a month we come together, keep each other accountable, and we talk about these ideas. And we pass around books like this and say, what do you think of this? What do you think of this guy? You know, where is he right? Where is he wrong? Those kinds of things. So I don't know if you guys all come to this church, but I would encourage you to start something like that. Pick up a book and assign a leader who is probably into that kind of a thing and make it a little bit tougher. Do something on some subject of apologetics and read together and discuss, meet once a week. Over potluck or whatever, once a month over potluck, and you will be amazed how much you grow from that. And then the honorific title of Director of Apologetics. I want to say to churches, I know church budgets are small, they can't afford staff, but do what our church did. So the church needs to identify someone who is into apologetics, and then just give them the honorific title of Director of Apologetics. So, and then have that title be printed on the bulletin, right below the associate pastor or something like that. So what that allows is for people and the leadership to say, we value all these good questions. If there's difficulties in the faith, you want to talk to this person right here. He's the director of apologetics at our church. You know, so I think that's cool. So the church has done that for me. I don't get paid to do that, but they've done that for me. But here's the other thing, too. We have a lady who actually has a PhD in biomechanics from Stanford. We made her the director of science and research. So, yeah, her title, her name is right there beside me. And then a couple other things here. Jeremiah 29, 4 to 7. I said, prepared, be prepared to suffer. We might be there, or we might be headed there. But I think it's optimistic. In Jeremiah 29, 4 to 7, the prophet Jeremiah is you know, again, what prophets do, delivering the message from God. At this time, the nation of Israel is already in exile. They're pretty bummed, obviously, to say the least, right? They lost the north, and then now the south. They're in exile. But the word, if you turn there to Jeremiah 29, 4 to 7, let me go there. If you have your Bibles with you, you can turn there. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I have sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon, build houses and live in them, plant gardens and eat their produce, take wives and have sons and daughters, take wives for your sons, and give your daughters in marriage, that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there, and do not decrease, but seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare. Kind of interesting, right? Babylon. We have it much better than than Babylon, for sure. Where, you know, instead of sending people to prisons, they burn them, right? King Nebuchadnezzar, right? So it's not like God was saying, strategize, guys. You know, you need to picket. You need to sign petitions because I need for you to overthrow King Nebuchadnezzar or whatever. No, it was nothing like that. It's kind of interesting. But basically, he's just saying to live a good life. Live a good life. And there's a lot of truth in that, I think. I know the famous thing is like, you know, preach the gospel and if appropriate, use words type of a thing. I forget who said that, but it's kind of like that. I think that's the challenge, is live a good life, and others will actually see that, and they will want to know what causes you to live such a good life. I think that's a good apologetic. And then finally, God is in control. So I want to go back to Oz Guinness, right? The facts are on the table. The stakes are high. And the moment of opportunity is closing. And unless the present generation restores civility in public life, the American Republic will decline. And just in closing, this always challenges me, you know. If not this, what? If not you, then who? If not here, where? If not now, when? All right. Questions, or do we have...